From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. Robin and Jeremy are off this week. U.S.-backed forces fighting the Islamic State entered Raqqa yesterday from the Syrian city's southern border. ISIS continues to lose ground in Syria and Iraq, but in other parts of the world, the group is gaining. And that includes Southeast Asia, where ISIS is waging a deadly insurgency in the Philippines. CNN's senior international correspondent Ivan Watson is following this story. He joins us on Skype. And Ivan, start with the fighting in the city of Marawi. What's happening there?
This has been incredible that a group of insurgents, an umbrella group of some long-standing Philippines insurgent groups, united and mounted a really audacious operation and succeeded in capturing much of the city of Marawi at the end of May. And then what's even more remarkable is that they essentially went toe-to-toe with the Philippines armed forces, effectively fighting the national military to a standstill. And you've got more than 340,000 civilians who've had to flee their homes, and the army has taken scores of casualties.
These extremist groups have been operating in the area for decades, since the 1970s, but these fighters have been described as ISIS-affiliated. What does that mean, and what kind of connections or relationships do they have with the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria?
What's remarkable here is that this coalition of different insurgent groups, they've really united for the very first time under the black banner of ISIS. They began pledging allegiance to ISIS in 2014, and the groups and the numbers of fighters have grown since then. After capturing Marawi, they engaged in apparent executions of prisoners, dressing them in orange and then shooting them dead, and of course filming this. So aping many of the strategies of ISIS that we've seen in the Middle East. And one of their goals has been to capture territory and formally declare it a province of the so-called Islamic Caliphate, but in Southeast Asia, not in the Middle East.
Right. So they're trying to establish a caliphate of their own right there in the Philippines.
Or attach it, rather, to the broader caliphate. So this is part of a global ideology to establish this very austere form of Islam and Sharia law around the world.
Well, Ivan, you spoke to a man who used to be a member of one of the Philippines' most notorious jihadi groups, and he told you that these fighters have had decades to establish sophisticated international smuggling networks. You agreed not to reveal his identity, but here is what he told you.
They can easily transport firearms and money very easily.
Between which countries?
Malaysia and the Philippines, through the southern back door.
Through the southern back door, what does that mean? And what role does geography play in all this?
Well, the Philippines is an island nation, and it neighbors other island nations, Malaysia and Indonesia. There are effectively an archipelago of islands there, and that's where insurgent groups, in particular, this man is a reformed member of perhaps the most notorious Philippines Islamist insurgent group, Abu Sayyaf. They have, in Abu Sayyaf's case, for decades operated among these islands, kidnapping, taking people hostage from islands in different countries, bringing them back to their island strongholds. And as this former insurgent explained to me, they've received ransoms on boats, essentially illegally, with boats smuggling in boatloads of cash to them in exchange for their prisoners. So as he explained it to me, the international links are there. They have existed for years and years. And it's only just recently that the three main nations here, Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines, have agreed to embark on trilateral anti-terror and anti-piracy joint naval patrols and on intelligence sharing. But they have a lot of catch-up to do. Mm. The insurgents have been doing this for years.
Well, how is the government responding? Of course, we know the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, has been spending all this time leading a brutal crackdown against the drug trade. Is he responding as strongly against the ISIS threat?
Duterte is the first president from the Philippines, from the southern island of Mindanao, where the crisis with this ISIS in the Philippines movement is taking place. He has spent the last year in office, his first year in office, describing illegal narcotics as an existential threat to the country and embarking on a very controversial policy that has involved the shooting deaths of hundreds, if not thousands, of suspected drug users and traffickers. But somehow, he and his government and armed forces and intelligence agency missed the ticking jihadi time bomb that was growing on his home island, essentially in his backyard. Now, since ISIS took over this entire city of Marawi, he very quickly imposed martial law on the island of Mindanao. He also authorized the military to carry out daily airstrikes against insurgent targets in the city of Marawi, which has caused a great deal of damage there. What's been striking is that his rhetoric has not been as harsh against the insurgents as it has been in the past against narcotics traffickers and users. He has been talking about the need for peace with the Muslim minority that lives on Mindanao and seems to be walking a finer diplomatic line when it comes to dealing with the insurgents and with the broader kind of deeper entrenched grievances that this Muslim minority have had on this island going back decades.
Huh, that is fascinating. Well, look, what does this say to you about the reach of the Islamic State, the fact that ISIS has emerged in Southeast Asia, even as it's lost ground in places like Iraq and Syria?
This is not a problem that's going away. We've seen the impact of ISIS-inspired attacks in the U.S., in Europe, and now, for the first time, we've seen an entire city taken over, albeit for a short period of time, all the way over in Southeast Asia. It proves that this ideology and the violence that comes with it can take root very far away from its place of origin.
Hmm. CNN's Ivan Watson, who has been reporting on the ISIS insurgency in the Philippines. Ivan, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome, Peter.
President Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner is making news, not about public policy, but about various business dealings and their lack of transparency. The Washington Post reports that just before the election, Kushner got a $285 million loan from Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank is a lender that had to pay a huge fine to New York state regulators for its role in aiding Russian money laundering. The issue? Kushner chose not to reveal the loan that he got. His lack of disclosure about that and about other dealings has been raising concern in Washington. NPR senior business editor Marilyn Giwax heads a team of reporters who track the Trump and Kushner family business interests. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi.
What is the story behind the Deutsche Bank loan?
Well, back in October, Kushner's real estate company got this loan, $285 million. It's a huge loan to finance one of his buildings in New York. And the problem is that Deutsche Bank had been, at that very time, negotiating with the U.S. government over a mortgage fraud case and with New York regulators over a money laundering problem involving, wait for it, Russian clients. Mm-hmm. So in the end, it had to pay a lot of huge fines for all of this. And the Post revelations about this Kushner debt to Deutsche Bank came at the same time that Kushner reportedly is now under review with the FBI about that Russian meddling into our election. The FBI is looking at Kushner, according to these reports, because he failed to disclose a separate meeting with a Russian banker last year. So he should have disclosed that meeting when he was getting his security clearance. So I know that sounds like a bunch of words. So just to separate it out, it's double trouble. He had an undisclosed loan with a bank that laundered money for Russians, and he also had an undisclosed meeting with a Russian banker.
So the FBI wants to know more about this. Did Jared Kushner personally sign for the Deutsche Bank loan?
Yeah, and that's the thing that's kind of weird about that, because Jared and his brother personally signed off as guarantors of those loans. And yet, when he filled out his financial disclosure forms for the Office of Government Ethics before he went to work at the White House, he didn't disclose this. You know, I mean, if I were on the hook for more than $250 million, I might remember that. So, you know, there's this other wrinkle to it, which is that it's not just Kushner. It's his father-in-law, too, just filed a financial disclosure last month, and it showed that he owes at least $150 million to Deutsche Bank. So here's the point of all of this babbling. Ethics experts say that when you owe a lot of money to somebody, you potentially have a gigantic conflict of interest. Your lender could go hard on you. Your lender could go easy on you. So you might be making decisions, policy decisions, that are being influenced by your indebtedness to the Deutsche Bank? And, you know, are you deciding things because it's in the best interest of the American people or because it's in the best interest for your loans?
So, Marilyn, bring this all together for us. Where is this going that Kushner has failed to disclose these financial ties?
Well, Democrats in the House are asking for more information about this. They want to know why he still has a security clearance if he had these undisclosed meetings with a Russian banker. But that's why the ethics experts also say nepotism is a bad idea, because he is the president's son-in-law. And it makes it tough, even if he does get into trouble, how do you fire the father of your grandchildren? So it's very complicated.
NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn G. Wax, you explained it very well, Marilyn. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
You've probably seen more than a few American flags displayed around your town to mark the 4th of July holiday. Good timing for a new book about flags, which comes out tomorrow. A Flag Worth Dying For, The Power and Politics of National Symbols, takes a look at the stories of dozens of the world's flags, both past and present. Tim Marshall is the author, and he joins us now from London. Tim, welcome.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Well, you begin the book with this iconic moment, the raising of the American flag over the wreckage of the World Trade Center after 9/11. And that sets up the whole premise of the book, that flags have this emotional impact over us. Is that right?
That's right. And also, I wanted to make sure from the start that people didn't think that flags were an old-fashioned thing, because then they're clearly not. And what was it that brought America together in those terrible days? It was the symbol of the nation, of the Union. And so I argue from the beginning, these things are emotionally as important as they ever were. You can have all sorts of arguments about the pros and cons of nationalism, but you can't argue that it's not still front and center.
Huh. Well, we are in the midst of the most patriotic holiday in the United States, so let's talk about the American flag. Earliest iterations of it came about in the 1760s, and that's before the United States even became a country.
Right, and that's why, you know, it became what it became. For example, you go all the way back to the Sons of Liberty. They, it is thought, flew a nine-striped flag during the Boston Tea Party, and that, it is thought, was a prototype for what became Stars and Stripes. A lot of this is lost in the murk. It's clear that the 13 states that had the temerity, Peter, the temerity to rise up against us and kick us out, that was clearly, you know, why there are 13 stripes. And so then woven into it is this history and this symbol of freedom. And then obviously we know what happened, unfortunately, in 1776. I mean, we can make United States Great Britain again, if you choose.
I digress.
But in 1777, that's when it actually became officially, as we know it, the Stars and Stripes, with some stars to be added on later. But in 1777 is when it reaches the iteration that we now recognize.
Well, maybe you could clear up some confusion for some of us here in the United States, because a lot of kids grew up in school, were taught that Betsy Ross, the seamstress who made flags for the Pennsylvania Navy, was the designer of the original American flag. But is that true?
Maybe. her family says yes. Others say no. It is not for me, despite writing a book about it, it's not for me to make that judgment. It is for proper historians to look into it. I like the Betsy Ross story. I'm not even convinced it's important, the actual fact of the matter, because when it comes to these things about flags, actually legends are of equal importance. They become the truth that you believe in.
All right, well, 1912, President Taft comes in, and he's responsible for codifying the design that we know it as today. And actually, this is interesting. There are laws for handling the flag according to the flag code. And, you know, I remember my father, who was in the military, always warning me that a flag could not touch the ground. That was a really big deal. So, you know, what are some of the other flag laws in the United States that we must adhere to?
You have more laws about your flag than almost any other country. For example, within the military, if it's tattered and torn, it has to be given either a decent burial or actually cremated. And the laws about that cremation ceremony go into several pages. How many people should be there? What should be said? A spare chair for somebody that has passed on that would have liked to have been there and valued it and all the rest of it. And what got me really interested in all this is I used to be a news reporter, and I was in Afghanistan and Iraq quite a lot. And in the States, I went to quite a few, very sadly, of the funerals at Arlington. And the ceremony there where the flag is folded so many times, and each fold is symbolic of something. And then the very last fold is symbolic as the stripes, the daylight, is folded into the darkness of night. And at that point, the flag becomes a triangular shape, a cockade shape, which is because that's the shape of the hat that the first revolutionaries fought against the British.
Hmm.
So all this historic symbolism swirls around in your flag.
It does evoke emotion in this country. For some people, it makes them feel very patriotic. For others, it feels like they're very left behind in this country. But what about your country, Great Britain, the Union Jack? Do people have a similar relationship to it?
Similar but very different, in that you are more openly patriotic. We do not tend to fly flags from our front porches or our backyards. It's just not done. But that doesn't necessarily mean the British are not patriotic. It's just that it's done in a different way, in a more official way. It is left mostly to the state and state buildings to fly the flags. So we have a different relationship, but underlying it is the same thing. And I take your point about people might be ambivalent. And we've had a particular problem here where the far right hijacked both the cross of St. George, the English flag, and the Union Jack, the British flag, for their own purposes. And it became a bit embarrassing sometimes to fly it because people would assume
you were
from the... But that is so, so unfair, because what it is supposed to stand for is liberty and justice for all, one nation under God. Now, the fact that you don't always live up to that, and no nation can ever live up to its values, it doesn't mean that that flag does not stand for those values, and you can still support those values.
Well, look, you know, some flags are very old, others are very new. 1994, South Africa was emerging from apartheid. Nelson Mandela had just been elected president. After 7,000 designs for a new flag had been rejected, people were starting to get a little bit concerned. They had this urgent need for a flag, and then who comes in but a 74-year-old retiree named Fred Brownell. Who is he, and how did he save the day in South Africa?
A retired civil servant who knew about heraldry and was interested in flags. They had 5 weeks to go before the transition of power from the de Klerk apartheid regime to the Nelson Mandela era. They had 100,000 flagpoles with the flag of apartheid, basically. And after these rejections, they basically rang up Fred and said, can you help? He very quickly put together the famous, now famous South African flag with the Y shape. It's got the red, the gold, and the green Pan-African colours. It's got the colours of the ANC, the political party, and the Inkatha, the Zulu political party there. The chili red was a nod back to the original flag because, of course, you had to incorporate the white population as well. He faxed it to Mandela. Of course, faxes in those days were black and white. This is 1994. I think, okay, I like the look of it, but what colour is it? And they had to send instructions. They had to run down to a shop, buy some crayons, colour in this flag, show it to Mandela. He said, fine, let's go for it. The flag factory in South Africa could only do 5,000 a week. With 5 weeks to go, you do the math. They need 100,000. So they had to actually send out back to the Netherlands, to the Dutch, and they came up with 100,000 flags, and they just managed to run them up the flagpole for the day he took power.
Huh. Fascinating. Well, there are also flags of fear, as you put it. The flag of the Islamic State on a black background. It has a white circle on it with Arabic script inside. ISIS would say what? This flag is inspired by the Prophet Muhammad.
That's right. They declared it their flag in 2007. It's not really their flag because that would be unfair, because it's square because the flag of Muhammad was thought to be square. It's black because the flag of Muhammad was supposed to be black. And on it is written the Shahada, the expression of faith that there is only one God. Now, all those things are not ISIS. They are all Islamic. And so it's unfair of ISIS to hijack it. But nevertheless, it has become their symbol. It screams radicalism if you look at the way it's written, it's in a very ragged script. And what the message they're sending, along with their barbarity of the way they behave, which goes back, you know, to the 6th, 7th centuries. So as well as acting like that, their flag actually suggests that they're going back to the original and back to the 7th century.
You write that it evokes fear. It is a flag of evil fanaticism. That may be true for us in the Western world. But do you think that when ISIS fighters see that flag fluttering in the distance, that they feel uplifted and inspired in much the same way that, say, Americans do when they see the Stars and Stripes?
Yes, you have to accept that. And you know, I don't buy this argument that this is nothing to do with Islam. It is not the form of Islam that the vast majority of Muslims in the world follow, but it does spring from it. It is absolutely a warped, and nearly every Muslim I know, every Muslim I know actually, detests ISIS. But you're right to say that it will inspire them.
So as you looked at the Islamic State flag and dozens of others around the globe as you wrote this book, what did you learn about patriotism?
That patriotism, for me, and in the context of looking at the flag and having an affinity with it, is a love of one's own and a respect for others. But nationalism is a love of one's own and a contempt for others. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is that we are experiencing an explosion of nationalism all over the world. And I think it's important to know these symbols, to recognize them, to know the power of them, and then to utilize them, that you can fight on this ground of identity, but stay the right side of the line. If you don't know what the hell it is you're looking at, and you cede those symbols to the other side, you will lose that battle. Hmm.
Tim Marshall, his new book is A Flag Worth Dying For, The Power and Politics of National Symbols. Tim, thank you.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions, and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle, and it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first three meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
On this day before Independence Day, state beaches and parks in New Jersey remain closed for a third day in a row. Well, closed to everybody except for the governor, that is, Chris Christie. There are aerial photographs of Christie and his family enjoying the sunshine and sand yesterday on the otherwise empty Island Beach State Park. One photograph made the front page of New Jersey's Star-Ledger newspaper today with the headline, "Gov Soaks Up Sun on Beach He Closed." Matt Arco is political reporter for the Star-Ledger. He joins us on Skype. Matt, how are the people in New Jersey reacting to this?
Yeah, look, the governor's approval rating is at 15% before this picture was on the front page of the paper and online, and I suspect it might go down a little bit after this.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is this is just terrible optics for the governor, who, you know, told everybody that he was going to be at Island Beach State Park. It wasn't a surprise. We knew that he was going to be there, but just the optics of it, you know, and now there's an actual picture to really throw in people's faces while the state government shutdown is going on is what's going to hurt the governor.
So the governor, not surprisingly for him, doesn't seem too apologetic or bothered by the odd optics, as you mentioned. Here he is on this morning's Fox 29 Philadelphia.
Oh, my God, what a scandal. He actually was with his wife and his children, and they caught him. Really, I'm telling you.
But, Governor, you can understand, though, why a lot of people are upset. They can't go to that beach. They want to be able to do what you were doing, and they can't.
Well, I'm sorry they're not the governor.
It sounds like he doesn't really care about that 15% approval rating, which may be on the downslide even now. Is it that the governor basically thinks since he's lame duck, he has not much to lose?
Well, you know, he's been saying publicly for a while when we ask him about it, look, guys, I told you this and I'm going to continue to tell you this. I don't care. I'm not running for re-election. It doesn't bother me. You know, there might be a part of him that it doesn't bother him, but it's certainly on a personal level, I'm sure, when it push comes to shove, it's not great to be where he is. But the fact of the matter is he isn't on the ballot. We're in the middle of a state shutdown where he is at an impasse with a Democratic lawmaker who is going to be on the ballot with every other Republican and Assembly and a Senate lawmaker in November. So, you know, the governor doesn't have to worry about this. You know, it hurts his legacy, but it's others who will be affected at the polls.
What's the cause of the stalemate?
So what's happened is that we have a controversial bill dealing with Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey. It's the state's largest insurer, but it's not a private insurer. It's a not-for-profit entity that was created by the state and regulated by the state. And now what the governor wants to do is he wants to put more oversight over the insurer, and he also wants to try to tap some of its reserves for the next governor to pay for not charity care, but sort of health care for poor New Jerseyans. It's a bipartisan bill that already passed the Senate. It has Democratic lawmakers supporting it. One of the only real people who are opposed to it is Assembly Speaker Vincent Prieto, who has refused to bring it up on the floor for a vote. And the reaction to that was lawmakers in his own caucus refused to vote on the state budget. They haven't voted on the state budget, so the state budget has not been sent to the governor. So an automatic state shutdown is what happens.
So in the meantime, people of New Jersey can't go to state parks. They are going to have a hard time getting to the Statue of Liberty. Any signs of the stalemate ending soon?
I'm not optimistic that it's going to end today, and it might not end tomorrow, but there's a lot of talk about it maybe ending Wednesday or by the end of the week. Because on Friday, if there's no resolution then the state's casinos close, and that's a whole other heap of trouble.
Oh, yeah. Matt Arco, political reporter for the Star-Ledger in New Jersey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
During the summer season, vacation spots across the nation need to find tens of thousands of temporary workers. There's a shortage of temp help, and that has more and more companies searching overseas. They're looking for low-skilled workers who come to the U.S. on what are known as H-2B visas, to be cooks and gardeners and cleaners. This year, the lack of workers is worse than ever amid confusion over the H-2B program. In a bipartisan effort, more than 30 senators are calling on federal agencies to increase the number of H-2B visas they issue. One vacation place hit hard by the shortage this summer is Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Bruce Gellerman, a Here and Now contributor WBUR, went there.
About 4 million tourists a year escape to the Cape. To keep them fed, housed, and happy requires an estimated 20,000 temporary workers.
Our son, he went out one day and got 5 jobs in the same day. One day. It is not difficult to get a job here.
Jane Nichols Bishop should know. She's president of Peak Season Workforce. Her Cape Cod company helps restaurants, resorts, and hotels navigate the complex and expensive federal process to obtain temporary work visas for foreigners.
We simply do not have enough Americans in our area to do temporary jobs. Americans want a year-round job, but many of our businesses are seasonal, temporary.
30 years ago, to address the seasonal worker shortage, Congress established a special guest worker program, allowing companies to hire foreigners to perform temporary, non-agricultural jobs. And every year since, lawmakers have set annual quotas on the number of so-called H-2B visas.
It is the most highly regulated work visa in the United States.
Employers seeking H-2B visas for workers have to prove they're a seasonal business. They have to advertise for local workers first and pay the prevailing wage. The Departments of Labor, Homeland Security, and State Department all have a hand in the H-2B visa program.
H-2B visas are temporary work visas. It does not displace an American. They cannot lead to citizenship. And without the H-2Bs for this season, the Cape will survive, but it will not thrive.
Tourism is a billion-dollar-a-year business on the Cape. The season now runs 8 months a year, and every year, companies eagerly await Congress's annual determination that sets a cap on the number of H-2Bs that are available. It's become an annual mad dash competition.
We simply don't have enough people to operate our business. We wouldn't be able to operate our business without them.
Mike Potenza of the Lobster Pot in Provincetown says the restaurant applied for the visas the very first day applications were accepted and luckily got all of the H-2Bs it needed.
But it was a very difficult, very contentious battle. We file our paperwork exactly as we should, exactly on time, and then we're literally at the mercy of the government to process those applications and clear those workers in time for us to put them to work for our season.
2 years ago, Congress made 66,000 H-2B visas available nationwide. And as it had done in years past, it permitted foreign workers who previously had visas back into the country without affecting the cap. Then last year, lawmakers decided to nearly double the cap, but eliminated the exemption for past visa holders. They left it up to Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly to decide just how many H-2Bs to authorize. Kelly wasn't having it.
wish Congress had not given me the 66,000 option. My sense was when I first took this job, if Congress had wanted it to be 129 or whatever thousand, that's what they would have passed.
And so now, amid uncertainty and confusion, with the tourist season in full swing, Cape Cod employers have been scrambling to find workers, says Jane Nichols Bishop.
They're usually behind the scenes. They're the housekeepers you don't see. They're the folks doing the dishes in the kitchen, prepping the food. They might be the cook that you just never see. It's the invisible workforce that supplements the American workforce. That's what H2B is.
People like Anthony Anglin, a line chef from Jamaica.
I'm really lucky. And I love it here. It's really awesome working here at Moby Dick's.
This is Anglin's second season working the fryers at Moby Dick's in Wellfleet on the Outer Cape. He was already in the United States when the new rules went into effect and had many seasonal job offers. But with the H-2B visa limit still in limbo, some of his fellow Jamaican workers weren't as fortunate.
It's very, very hard. Because some of my friends went back home and they couldn't come back on the H-2B visa. I hope things change.
Todd Barry, the owner of Moby Dick's, was lucky because he offered Anglin his old job while Anglin was still in the United States on an H-2B visa.
We're really fortunate here. I had asked for 9 H-2B visas, people that worked for me from last year, and I've got 4.
So faced with a shortage of seasonal workers, Todd Barry hired other foreigners, students.
Hi, I'm Bojana. I'm a J-1 student. I come from Serbia.
20-year-old waitress Bojana Savanovic has a student J-1 visa. The Cultural Educational Exchange visa allows her to travel and work in the U.S. for up to 5 months.
I wanted to visit America to meet the country and the culture and to improve my English skills also.
J-1 workers are a short-term fix to a longer-term problem. Foreign students have to go back to their home countries at the end of August, but the Cape season runs through mid-October. That's why Todd Barry says he prefers experienced H-2B visa holders. They can work from the beginning of the season to the end.
You try and put the pieces of the puzzle together. You know, I'm hearing some horror stories in P-Town about businesses getting no one. It's just so intense.
Musicians in Provincetown draw a small crowd on Commercial Street.
Thank you.
P-Town, as it's called, is at the end of the Cape. It's where the worker shortage is most acute. During the winter, the P-Town population shrinks to about 1,000. In the summer, it swells to nearly 90,000. Paul Melanson, co-owner of Tin Pan Alley Restaurant, says rather than go through the expense and bureaucracy to qualify for those H-2B visas and the anxiety waiting for Congress to decide how many to issue, he hires foreign undergrads who visit the states on those J-1 visas.
As far as our labor shortage this year, I was worried about it in the winter and the spring, but I sponsored 17 J-1 students, and they all got their visas. So I'm completely 100% staffed and maybe even overstaffed by one or two people.
But the downside, compared to J-1 student workers, H-2B visa holders are usually older, more mature, and experienced.
The J-1s are students, so you're not getting a real skilled workforce. You know, you're training them on the job for the most part.
During the height of the summer crunch this year, Cape tourists can expect slower service and longer lines.
Nobody clap! What I'm about to show you is the hardest trick, harder than all the other tricks in the show combined.
A street performer does his act near the Lobster Pot. The vibe at the Provincetown landmark is laid back. The restaurant is P-Town's largest private employer. 40% of the workforce, 60 employees, are on H-2B visas. Restaurant spokesman Mike Potenza says to attract seasonal foreign workers, it pays more than the prevailing wage and provides low-cost housing. But this year, because of uncertainty in the H-2B program, the Lobster Pot had to open a month late.
So that's a whole month that we're not buying fish from our fish vendors, and we're not buying napkins, and we're not buying all the other ancillary products that support our business. Therefore, we're negatively impacting the businesses around us.
So we have severe and real shortages here of workers, and businesses have signs up all over town.
Town manager David Panagor says the economic fallout has hit P-Town hard, and there are social and political impacts as well. Residents recently decided not to make Provincetown a sanctuary city for immigrants. Panagor says people were afraid of retribution by the Trump administration.
Here in Provincetown, if we wound up in the crosshairs of the federal government, we would lose our J-1 and our H-2B visa workers is what we were concerned about, which is really the basis of our economy. So we would actually be removing the ability of businesses to pay taxes.
From Town Hall, you can hear musicians play for tourists on Commercial Street and see just beyond Provincetown Harbor. It's where the nation's first immigrants, the Pilgrims, stepped ashore on a foreign land seeking sanctuary from religious violence in Europe. Now, nearly 400 years later, faced with a shortage of workers, Provincetown would welcome an influx of foreigners seeking temporary jobs that Americans don't want, but has to leave many stranded on distant shores. For Here and Now, I'm Bruce Gellerman.
Later today on All Things Considered, drain the swamp is a popular slogan in politics these days, but it doesn't work so well in nature. A massive swamp in part of Virginia and North Carolina has been dramatically altered over the centuries by loggers and developers, and scientists say the changes have created an environment more vulnerable to floods and wildfires. That story later today on All Things Considered. You're listening to Here and Now.
In American culture, fewer teenagers are spending their summers working as lifeguards, checkout clerks, and as ticket takers at the movie theaters. In fact, in recent decades, the summer job has been disappearing. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us as he does each Monday from New York. Hey, Derek, welcome back.
Hello.
You've been writing about this. What do the numbers say about how many teenagers are working these days?
The numbers say it's going down. In the summer of 78, 60% of teenagers were either working or looking for work. Last summer, just 35%.
Wow.
So since the 1970s, you essentially have a 50%, well, 40 to 50% decline in the number of teenagers who are looking for work or working. That is pretty dramatic. And what's more, teenagers are also less likely to say that they want to work. So something big is going on.
Okay, something big is going on, and there are some theories about why this is happening. One, perhaps mistaken theory, is that kids are just lazier these days. You say what?
Maybe they're just lazy. That's certainly the easiest explanation for anything having to do with young people not behaving the same way their parents remember. But here's the problem with the lazy thesis. What appears to be happening is that teenagers are less likely to work in paid jobs, but more likely to take internships, which are unpaid, and therefore the Bureau of Labor Statistics says they don't count as a job, or take summer classes. The share of teenagers in summer school has grown from about 15% in 1985 to more than 50% today. So it's almost quadrupled, essentially. Much more kids in summer school, much more kids taking unpaid internships that in government statistics don't appear to be working because it's not in exchange for money. That explains most of it. The OECD keeps track of what are called NEETs, teens who are neither N, employed in education or training, N-E-E-T. That number hasn't budged since the 90s. So it would appear that teenagers are just as busy as they used to be. They're just busy in unpaid internships or summer school.
What is that about? Because I'm thinking that if you have more kids in school, and that's why they're not working, it kind of doesn't make sense because school is as expensive as it's ever been, if not more expensive, especially when you get to college. So why aren't these kids working?
So here's a theory that spins off of the minimum wage. Let's say the minimum wage is getting too high in some states. There might be an employer who says, all right, I'll hire a teenager for $5, but I will never do it for $10 or $15, and that's new minimum wage. Therefore, sorry, no dice, kid. I'm not going to hire you for the 17-year-old for 2.5 months. The other thing that might be happening, though, is that teenagers and their families might be making a rather sophisticated calculation that says, I can make much more money from my college degree if I study really hard and pack on more extracurricular activities and put together the perfect college application portfolio. And as a result, you might see more people going to college, preparing for college, than doing summer school. Indeed, if you graph the share of high school graduates who are enrolled in college versus the teen participation rate, what you find is that college attainment seems to be rising at exactly the moment that teen working working seems to be declining. Mm-hmm. So it really does seem like there is a relatively one-for-one shift of teens not working in the economy and rather preparing for their college career.
But isn't there a loss? Because every summer, kids have been going to work as lifeguards at the pool, at the library, wherever they work. They have a lesson in life as opposed to a lesson in the classroom.
It's a totally fair point. Don't these jobs, whether it's scooping ice cream, being a lifeguard, working retail, don't they teach responsibility or soft skills or at least a humbling tolerance for the fact that lots of jobs are terrible? Yes, in fact, there are enormous number of economic studies that suggest that summer jobs can pay a long-term dividend. But the fact is that there are many more studies that show a long-term dividend from A, high school completion, and B, college attendance. And it turns out that people are more likely to finish college if they're not working part-time in many circumstances. So I would say, looking at all of these numbers together, that yes, there is a loss for some young people in the fact that they are no longer working during the summer. But if they're spending that time in summer school, in building a college application, in preparing to complete a college degree and move on to a multi-decade college-based career, that might be a very positive trade-off.
If teenagers aren't doing the typical low-skilled summer job, who is?
Older workers, number one, and low-skill immigrants, number two. For example, a job that is rather typical for teenagers historically is the office administrative job. So the teenager takes a job as a secretary at her, you know, dad's friend's office or something like that. Those jobs are now much more likely to be taken by immigrants or by elderly Americans. Hmm. And so you have a situation where teenagers are not only choosing to focus on education rather than go to a summer job, but also that those summer job positions are now more likely to be filled by non-teenagers.
Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.